This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
It's going out of business, clearance, big deals, store, busted holidays, customer appreciation, inventory reduction.
Who knows what on earth is going on? Every year, the World Watch Institute issues its annual State of the World Report. This year, 60 authors work out the numbers to find out the awful truth. We're buying into a dying world. Joining us on Radio EcoShock is the project director, Eric Asadourian. Welcome, Eric.
Thanks.
Why focus on consumerism now, just when governments and economists are telling us to get out and shop to save the economy?
For that very reason, Alex. We are embedded in a consumer culture, and more of the world is, and that is not going to solve our problems, neither in the short term nor in the long term. And in fact, it is undermining the ecological systems that allows us to thrive as a species. So if we don't start shifting our cultures away from consumerism, this recession that we're in is going to look like fun and games compared to the world we'll walk into.
And we both know that consumerism goes a lot deeper than just advertising in the mall. Your report describes it as a culture. What are some of the aspects of the psychology behind this?
If I can answer that a little bit more deeply. So we talk about culture specifically and consumerism as a cultural pattern or a paradigm in a sense that more and more cultures are orienting around. And culture, in the kind of simplest terms, is the sum of all the social processes. This radio program, the phone calls you have, the Facebook updates, the face-to-face interactions, all these social processes that add up to make the human-constructed world feel natural, right? So the fact that I wear clothes and I eat the foods that I eat and I don't eat other foods like insects, even though they're healthy and sustainable, perhaps, you know, all these things are set by our cultures so that we assume that they're natural or we take them as givens. But really, culture's role is to shape our reality. And unfortunately, right now, consumerism is a guiding force in our cultures so that literally our well-being, our self-worth, and our social status, just about every aspect, is quite intricately tied with our consumption patterns. And obviously that is not a sustainable or viable system to base a culture on.
Well, I don't mean to pick on Americans because I know Canadians and Europeans have been on a buying binge too, but can you give us a quick profile of the ecological cost of the average American lifestyle?
One of the statistics we point to in the report is that as an individual American, the average American, their lifestyle leads to the extraction of 88 kilograms of materials every day. You know, that's larger than most Americans weigh. That's not because of greed or anything like that. It's just because we live in a culture that reinforces these high consumption patterns. So, you know, we consume too many materials. We understand our well-being as quite closely tied with how large our homes are or how many pets we have or how large our TV screen is, all these things. And we have to work intentionally to shift cultural patterns away from valuing those things and instead valuing living sustainably or even better, living as a restorative force for the environment.
So just for me to get up in the morning, somebody out there is digging up enough metals and pouring enough roads and cutting down enough trees and hauling enough stuff that my own body weight is going to be used up just for me to get through the day?
In essence, yes. You know, we have to add a larger number of materials than just metals, but I mean, you know, the average annual emissions of an American is 20 tons of CO2, and that's the average. You know, if you actually, I've seen some statistics where you break it apart by income demographic, and at higher income levels, the average American is using 70, 80 tons of emissions. Or is producing that much. And so you have carbon or coal, you have oil, you have water and soils and, you know, metals and sand and, you know, pretty much just about everything is such a material intensive process these days that we are literally using that much. The number in global terms is we as a world extract 112 Empire State's buildings of worth of materials every day.
That is amazing. And you know, attics and basements and garages are loaded with the plunder of past shopping. Some people rent storage lockers just to hold all their extra stuff, and dumps are filling up with brand new items never used but tossed out. There's even a TV show called Hoarders, a reflection of the national preoccupation. Do these things really make us happier?
The answer is so obvious to me, and through some of the psychological research that I've looked at and through these data sets, that I actually didn't even spend much time in the report talking about that. There's just a box in the first chapter. Because, first of all, it's irrelevant in a sense if this high consumption lifestyle makes us happy or not, because even if it does in the short term, it is undermining our long-term security and ability to be happy in the future. So it should not be the way we proceed. But then, even if you assume that resources are infinite, the answer is still no. If you look at the side effects of our consumer lifestyle, increasing hours, commuting to work, because we all want larger houses and that leads to suburbanization, higher obesity levels, literally 1.6 billion people are overweight worldwide. And that's more than the 1.0 billion people who are underweight. And that leads to diabetes and heart disease, shorter lifespans, all sorts of different illnesses and lowered quality of life. You know, we could keep the best pieces of progress and strip away all the side effects that came with, excessive consumption, and we would keep the happiness and get rid of all the negative costs, and then I think we would really be much happier. If we weren't overweight, if we weren't creating sickness or increasing social isolation because we live in one community, we drive 2 hours, we go to work in another community, drive home, and then are so exhausted from working too many hours and commuting that instead of going out and engaging our community or going out with friends, we end up watching, on average, 4 hours of TV a day. And so it's all kind of a positive feedback cycle where we're just exhausting ourselves and making ourselves less happy through this lifestyle.
Well, according to your new report, we've seen a huge jump in consumerism in the past 40 years, and especially in the last 10 years. Is that part of the easy credit bubble?
I would say that would exacerbate it. But the major driver, especially in the last years, is the globalization process, where in order to provide more of these cheap goods, we outsourced some of the production to countries like China and India, which created new wealth there, which then made them a target to spread a consumer pattern there in order to stimulate their consumption. There's a lot of money to be made in stimulating consumerism, to say it bluntly. And so consumer interests have really worked intentionally to redirect cultural norms to stimulate consumption. And that's not just in developing worlds, but as I was doing this research, I came across a great book called Fighting Traffic that goes into the intentional strategic redesign of cities by automobile industry in the early 1900s in the United States, using all the different institutions that they could to normalize the use of the automobile in cities, right? So not just simple ways like advertising or creating special interest groups like auto clubs to put pressure on, building more roads, but, really ingenious ways like creating cartoons and putting them into class curriculums to make it clear to children to stay out of the roads, packaged as a safety message, but really to reorient norms in the next generation so that they understand that roads belong to cars and not to children, right? So they worked with police intentionally to start arresting jaywalkers, and even creating the term jaywalkers was a strategic move in order to make it so that it was wrong to walk in the street. Of course, it wasn't before there were cars. So it was a real great strategic move by the automobile industry to really drive forward a car-centric urban center. And you can see that replicated in developing countries that were very bike and walking focused until recently, but cities like Shanghai literally banned biking because it was a nuisance for cars. And so you're seeing the same cultural shifts going on in developing countries now, which will, of course, drive higher consumption.
Well, you've mentioned institutions. Can we use some of our existing institutions to change towards sustainability?
I'm glad you asked, because that's actually about 80% plus of the book. The first opening chapter talks about the doom and gloom of consumerism and where it's leading us, and that wasn't the goal of this report at all. In fact, I think it's been done many times, and I think hopefully our readers and your listeners already understand that. What the book mostly focuses on are the six institutions, key institutions, that can be harnessed in order to redirect cultures away from consumerism and towards sustainability. And those six institutions quickly are business, education, the media, governments, and then two that I found particularly interesting, traditions and social movements. So the obvious ones, you know, business, of course, is a major driver of the problem, but it also could be a real positive, where you can, you know, only our culture says that the mission of business is to maximize profit. We could, and groups are already shifting this to make it understood that the mission of business is to maximize social benefit, right? So there are more and more social enterprises being created. There are groups like B Corporation Lab, which is literally creating a new corporate charter so that the right framework that reinforces positive behavior by businesses that incorporate under this label will actually be bound to maximize social good and not just maximize profit. And there's a lot of great innovations in the business sector and economic sector, like shortening work hours and intentionally working within businesses to change business cultures. But it goes much beyond the business sector, where we can literally start changing cultures using the media and advertising, what they call social marketing, using arts and cinema. Avatar is an interesting example of, you know, it was not done intentionally, I don't think, by the studio, or at least the studio wasn't trying to promote sustainability, but it was a profitable movie. But in the process, it will, I think, have a subtle effect. You know, it basically, the movie really reinforces this idea that we are dependent and connected to a broader planetary system. And the more cultural stories that come out that reinforce that, you know, stories like WALL-E that show a giant corporation called By and Large, which literally destroyed the planet, and all that were left were some obese humans living in space. You know, the more kind of stories that reinforce that consumerism is not a good choice and that there are better alternatives, the more a new cultural norm or a cultural story will start infecting people and hopefully drive them to become what we call in the report cultural pioneers, people who take these ideas and strategically start trying to change or use the institutions that they have influence over to create a new culture of sustainability.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. We're talking with Eric Asadourian from the World Watch Institute. Their latest annual report is State of the World 2010, Transforming Cultures from Consumerism to Sustainability. Find out more at worldwatch.org. Eric, advertisers and big business as they are now, they're not going to like your new message, I would think. Have you had any pushback or difficulty getting this out?
Not yet, I think, and I'm glad to hear that, although Rush Limbaugh, of course, ranted on his show about our new report, which I find as a good sign, not a bad one. But I think the key is to think about this strategically and accept that this is a gray path that will make this work. I'm thinking, and maybe it's not the best example, but it's in my head, so I'll share it. You know, Brita water filters is an example. On the dark side, this company is owned by Clorox, which, you know, has for a long time polluted our water systems with, you know, the chlorine that they produce. But at the same time, they've been doing advertisements to stimulate sales of their filters, which good in their business sense. But it's also good because they're directly attacking bottled water companies. And the norm that's become, the desire to use bottled water has become a cultural norm in many places, and trying to extract that most effectively will take some gray partnerships, perhaps. NGOs have been, you know, like the Center for New American Dream, have been creating all these don't use bottled water campaigns, but they don't have the resources to get that message out broadly enough. but perhaps it will take some partnerships with those that have the funding and the motivation to stimulate a different path, if that makes sense. So maybe it's worth, in the short term, working with Brita to get people to get filtered water, and then once people are out of the cultural habit of drinking bottled water, then we work with a different ally to get them out of the habit of using filters by rebuilding our public water infrastructure so filters aren't needed at all.
Right. If we can get the pesticides and the various other chemicals out of our water supplies in the first place, we should be able to just get it right out of the tap. I wanted to ask you, your World Watch president, Christopher Flavin, suggests the current economic crisis could be an opportunity for big change. How could the downturn help us?
It's an important question. It's one I've looked at a lot over the last year, in part charged to do so by Chris. I think he really hopes that, and many people in the environmental community hopes that we could really use the recession as a way to start shifting our cultures. And I hope we can. The problem is you need to have some of those ideas in place beforehand so that people can grasp onto them. When the economic situation started tumbling so quickly, people were going from large homes, not to smaller homes, not to just downsizing, but to hotel rooms or motel room. And that's not sustainable, that doesn't contribute to well-being, of course, and is seen as deprivation. So I think in the short-term reaction phase to the recession, I don't think we were able to kind of shift behavior because people were literally abandoning pets and sad about it, not saying, you know, maybe I don't want a pet in the first place. So now that it's become a little bit more stabilized, if we could proactively start saying, okay, let's somehow find ways to disincentivize the desire to buy large homes, to encourage people to live more simply, even instead of trying to generate many, many more jobs and unsustainably grow our economy, instead, let's start shortening the work week or increasing vacation time so that there will be more job sharing. Or a better distribution of work. This is a topic that I find especially important. In fact, it's the only topic in State of the World that's so important that it has two chapters focused on it rather than one. There's one by Juliet Shore on work hours, but then one by John DeGraff specifically talking about how to create a movement to stimulate shortening work hours. It's called the Take Back Your Time movement. So I think that's a real strategic tool, is get people to work fewer hours and encourage the government to support that shift. One, you have better distribution of work, and so less unemployment and more job security and all of that. But the other benefit is that people have have more time and more ability to enjoy their calmer lifestyle, but also they'll have less discretionary income, which from maybe a personal view doesn't sound as exciting, although it's a trade-off. You get more time, you have more time to spend with your family and friends and do leisure activities. But from an ecological perspective, there is a strong correlation between the more money you have, the more impact you have, right? Because you can travel more, you can own a larger home, you can buy a car, and all those things. So one of the most strategic levers, I think, would be really pushing for a better distribution of jobs and shortening work hours.
Can you give us just a couple more positive examples as we head towards the end here where people are changing to avoid consumerism?
Sure. We really go throughout the different institutions. I mean, education is one that's really, you can see transformation at just about every level. Every level meaning, from primary school all the way to the university or professional schools, but pretty much every aspect of education is starting to, in some ways, reinforce sustainability. Curriculums are greening and classroom practices. The school meals are being changed so that they're healthier and more sustainable and lower on the food chain and not so processed and filled with junk food and soda and crap that children, unfortunately, get accustomed to eating early on. But there's also school gardening movements, which has become very popular, through Michelle Obama's work. But even the walk to school or the commute to school is starting to shift. In Italy, in this small town, Lecco, Italy, there's 450 students, and they all now walk to school in what they call pieta buses, or walking buses. So here's a small example, which by itself might seem insignificant, but when you add it up to a whole curriculum shift, it adds to it. But you have these children walking to school, you know, experiencing the changing seasons, getting a little bit of exercise, not using cars or fossil fuel-based transportation, you know, walking as a community group. It's a whole transformation of the commute to school. And when you add that to healthier meals and a green curriculum and gardening programs and all these other aspects, you're retraining children from a very early age to see their role in the world differently. And you can do that at not just in schools, but you know, across every sector of society.
We've been talking with Eric Asadourian of the World Watch Institute. Their new report, A State of the World 2010, Transforming Cultures from Consumerism to Sustainability. Eric, how can people get this report with all those useful numbers and ideas?
There is a preview edition right on our World Watch Transforming Cultures blog. It's the easiest link is transformingcultures.org, and that'll direct you to the blog site. And you can find the preview there. And, of course, you can buy the full edition at our website at worldwatch.org.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock, and thanks so much for talking with us, Eric.
My pleasure, Alex. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
The official title is State of the World 2010, Transforming Cultures from Consumerism to Sustainability. The January 12th press release from the World Watch Institute has a different tone, from Madison Avenue to Mad Max. Yes, indeed. World Watch's annual State of the World report has been a kind of standard used and quoted by reporters, bloggers, authors, and researchers. But let's take a quick look at this year's report. It's 262 pages, 1995 as a paperback, but just $9.95 as a downloadable PDF or Kindle file from worldwatch.org. I'm going to start off this quick review by reading a few bits from the report. Quote, in 2008 alone, people around the world purchased 68 million vehicles, 85 million refrigerators, 297 million computers, and 1.2 billion mobile cell phones. Consumption has grown dramatically over the past five decades, up 28% from the $23.9 trillion spent in 1996, and up sixfold from the $4.9 trillion spent in 1960, and that's in 2008 dollars. Some of this increase comes from the growth in population, but human numbers only grew by a factor of 2.2 between 1960 and 2006. Thus, consumption expenditures per person still almost tripled. That's a quote from the opening chapter by Eric Asadourian. And here's some more. Between 1950 and 2005, for example, metals production grew sixfold, oil consumption eightfold, and natural gas consumption 14-fold. In total, 60 billion tons of resources are now extracted annually, about 50% more than just 30 years ago. Today, the average European uses 43 kilograms of resources daily, and the average American uses 88 kilograms, end quote. And here's another one. According to a study by Princeton ecologist Stephen Pakala, the world's richest 500 million people, roughly 7% of the world's population, are currently responsible for 50% of the world's carbon dioxide emissions, while the poorest 3 billion are responsible for just 6%. In 2006, the 65 high-income countries, where consumerism is most dominant, accounted for 78% of consumption expenditures, but just 16% of the world's population. People in the United States alone spent $9.7 trillion on consumption that year, about $32,400 per person, accounting for 32% of global expenditures, with only 5% of global population. It is these countries that most urgently need to redirect their consumption patterns, as the planet cannot handle such high levels of consumption.
Nice toys they have nowadays. Nice toys. The toys we had were simpler, ever so much simpler. Noah's Arks and wooden soldiers. Nothing complex like these.
Well then, what is consumerism? Here's a quote. Consumer is a cultural pattern that leads people to find meaning, contentment, and acceptance primarily through the consumption of goods and services, end quote. You and I know it's a lot more than that when we dive into the psychology of why people shop and why they pile up so much stuff around them.
Kept on piling up and piling up and piling up. And that's basically where it's at right now. It just piled to the max.
She is obsessed with the stuff.
I think shopping, for some strange reason, gave me some kind of comfort. I guess I just kept trying to mask and hide what was really going on with the grief and loneliness.
That's a bit from the TV program Hoarders, but we're all hoarders compared to most of the world's citizens. I justify my pile, you justify yours. Not surprisingly, the report finds the primary driver of consumption is business out to make a buck. Advertising plays a critical role, assisted by a complicit and uncritical media, which is supported by that advertising. Governments are devoted to pushing consumerism. In our interview with Eric, we briefly touched on the institutions that can work to reshape our values beyond relying on disposable things to express our identity. One chapter is devoted to the possibility that world religions could engage believers to take better care of the earth, and there are examples of most religions experiencing some greening. Ducking nothing, the next chapter is about environmentally sustainable childbearing. It's not called population control, but does offer some guidelines for the perplexed and positive examples from around the world. The role of women is, of course, very important. Albert Bates, famous for his engagement in The Farm in Tennessee, and Toby Hemenway write a helpful chapter, From Agriculture to Permaculture. The goal is a food system that can be sustained for centuries without fossil fuels or harsh chemicals. Given the limited nature of gas and oil on this planet, plus their impact on our atmosphere, this is a do-or-die change for humanity. In my opinion, the idea of using our education system to create a new generation of non-consumers is going to be very controversial for many in the United States and in other places. Big corporations have already invaded many classroom settings, providing so-called learning materials that inject their brands or products. This year's report from World Watch contains a chapter on commercialism in children's lives. World Watch says, quote, U.S. marketers now spend $17 billion annually targeting children. That's up from $100 million in 1983, end quote. From what I've seen, present consumers hold their right to buy up the natural world as deeply as any religious belief. They will likely fight so-called greens trying to reshape the minds of their children. The classrooms do hold the best hope, but early childhood education to transform cultures for sustainability, well, that's going to be a battle. One of the most important steps, the World Watch report suggests, is to reconnect kids with nature. Many have not ventured outside the city or beyond the PlayStation. In fact, some young people need to learn to play outside without plastic toys. That's part of being human for thousands of years. I can't cover every chapter. It turns out school food can be critical not only in later health prospects, but the way the next generation perceives the world and their role in it. And the push on education goes on into universities and particularly the slant taught in business schools. You'll like Juliet Shore's chapter on sustainable work schedules for all. Could you enjoy some more time affluence? Did you know the average American puts in 200 to 300 more hours at work each year than the average European does? Keith Varnish wrote me an email questioning this World Watch report. If the Institute agrees consumerism is killing the planet, why do they recommend mere changes to that civilization, one that is devoted to consumption? Varnish claims we need much more fundamental change, much faster, and I tend to agree with him, but you'll have to find your own spot on this continuum. I think the Institute has been fairly brave in calling out the commercial drive that replaced our personal lives and our shared free culture. World Watch has collected success stories and alternative approaches from around the world. They're few, but they have found them. These alternatives haven't caught on yet in any real big way, but they could. I see lots of facts and good ideas here. Let's take them as suggestions for a better world. Some of you could find starting points for your own efforts or even life campaigns. Your struggle to save a world worth living in. To find out more, visit www.worldwatch.org. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
At the Copenhagen Climate Conference, they pledged $10 billion a year for developing countries to mitigate or adapt to climate change. Our next guest suggests the people who will be most impacted may never see the money. David Satherwaite is senior fellow in the Human Settlements Group of the International Institute for Environment and Development, the IIED. Among other things, David is the editor of the journal Environment and Urbanization, plus a book on adapting cities to climate change. David, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
We've heard a lot about the impacts of floods or drought on agricultural areas. Can you tell us more about the impact on cities?
Well, cities inevitably have a huge area of that is made impermeable by buildings and infrastructure and roads. And unless you have quite a sophisticated system to channel away water, pretty much every time it rains, it floods. And so in places where you've got heavy rainfall, floods in cities become almost the norm. Many of the cities I work in Africa and Asia, half the city doesn't have a drainage system because they live in informal settlements, illegal settlements, and where there's no government infrastructure.
Yes, I've seen pictures, for example, of Jakarta underwater and parts of Manila, and this seems to be a regular occurrence.
It is often a regular occurrence, although usually it's only the poor areas of the city that get flooded.
That's very reminiscent of New Orleans, for example.
No, absolutely. But this is such a regular occurrence. Poor New Orleans got hit by an unusually strong hurricane. In the informal settlements in Lagos, they flood four times a year. Where you've got no drainage, it floods pretty much every time it rains heavily.
So really, we're talking about people who live in what we would call slums, and I've heard estimates that up to 1 billion people are there, and the UN has said that may grow in years to come. You claim that the money pledged to help countries to adapt to climate change may not reach those people at all. Why not?
Well, slums is the wrong word for them. A lot of these are informal settlements built by the inhabitants themselves. Often they have a lot of competence and capacity to build. What they need is support to put in the pipe water, the sewers, the drains, the basic infrastructure. My worry is that if a city government refuses to work with the people living in informal settlements or what are sometimes called slums, then any money for adaptation isn't going to go to the slums.
Right. This is so hard for people, I think, in the West to imagine that governments at various levels have actually abandoned a large number of people that are living around the city. They don't get electricity, they don't get health care, they don't get schooling, and it seems to me that some of these governments just wish these people would somehow go away. Am I wrong about that?
No, you're absolutely right. One of the crazy things is, of course, people move to cities because there's economic opportunity there. So the reason that Lagos has grown, that Mumbai has grown, that Delhi has grown, is that there's more jobs there. People make rational choices and move there. The prosperity of these cities also depends on these people moving there. They provide cheap labor. A lot of the enterprises and entrepreneurs are also in what are labeled slums. The problem is that governments haven't changed their structure to cope with this growth in the labor force, growth in the population. And this isn't a problem just of poor cities. Very successful cities have half or more of their population in informal settlements.
I want to run a rather strange idea by you, perhaps. It seems to me, now I'm reading in the newspapers, that places like Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, or Miami, Florida, are slipping towards complete bankruptcy. Services are going to be slashed, and the poor will suffer first and most, as always, by this withdrawal. And we see some of these scenes maybe playing out in the future in Britain and Spain or Greece. Once we toss in climate disruption, a violent storm or heat wave, is it possible that some of our Western cities will begin to have, you know, tent cities and some of these same problems that we've always associated with being far away overseas.
The scale of the problem and the difficulties of resolving them are very different. In Europe and in North America, there's the money, there's the competence, there's the capacity to protect cities and protect low-income areas. It's a political choice if insufficient provision is made to do so. But in many of the countries and cities I work, city governments haven't got the investment capacity. And even where city governments have moved towards working with the inhabitants in informal settlements, it's still very difficult to find the money to invest in the storm and surface drains. Also, most of the cities most at risk from storms, from tornadoes, from hurricanes, are in lower middle income nations. Most of the cities most at risk from sea level rise are in lower middle income nations. So they face greater risks, and their governments usually have less resources to address those.
Have you personally been to some of these cities that are at risk of some climate disaster?
Oh, yes, many of them. Yes, absolutely. I think it's wrong to try and speak about cities that you don't know at least something about.
Mm-hmm. And which ones would you rank at the top of being at risk?
It's difficult to rank them precisely. At the moment, we have very few detailed risk assessments for particular cities. But Alexandria in Egypt, a large part of it is below sea level rise, and it's very vulnerable to storm surges. The whole series of major cities on the West African coast are very close to the sea, very close to lagoons, Lagos, Abidjan, Saint-Louis in Senegal, Dakar in Senegal. Then you've got the obvious very large cities in India, especially those on the east coast in the path of hurricanes, cyclones. Then you've also got Dakar in Bangladesh. Some of the Shanghai is at risk from storm surges. So almost any port is going to have large parts of it low-lying and therefore be at risk from storm surges and sea level rise.
I'd like to get to the idea of climate migration a little bit later on, but while we're talking about this, is there not just the possibility that these very populous areas, some people will just move inland and move their economies inland?
The companies and corporations can do so. It's as they make investments, they factor in, well, obviously cheap labor, often an avoidance of areas with unions. They factor in good infrastructure. They can simply factor in likely climate risks over the next 20 to 30 years. So you can see patterns of corporate investment changing in response to a risk. The difficulty is that lower middle income groups in those cities really don't have the same facility to move. You know, Mumbai is a city I love. I go to Mumbai every 6 months. It's a wonderful, warm, vibrant, crazy city. It's the home to 15 million people. It's where their homes are. It's where their culture is. It's where their livelihoods are. It's where their family are. How can you move 15 million people? And to where would you move them? And how would you reproduce all the livelihoods and the social networks that are so critical for their health and their survival? What worries me is that middle and upper income groups and wealthy enterprises can move to adapt. An awful lot of low income groups can't.
Well, on the positive side, as you mentioned, even when I went through the infamous favelas around the hills of Rio, where the police dared not go, there were many signs of community self-organization on their own. People had brought in power lines and they were building brick homes. They'd carry a brick up every day, plastic piping for water. Can you tell us about this self-organization that happens in these giant urban areas?
Well, the funny thing is that, you know, many cities, half the building stock was built by low-income groups. And it's called slums because it was built illegally and it lacks infrastructure and services. But with a little bit of government support, you can actually transform these into very desirable, nice, good quality areas. The government of Thailand has been supporting through the Community Organizations Development Institute. They support savings groups formed by slum dwellers to come together, organize to buy or to rent the land that they're squatting on. and upgrade or build very good quality housing. So all over the urban areas in Thailand, you can visit these very nice residential areas where you and I would love to live, which 2 to 3 years ago were awful informal settlements. In Latin America, the return to democracy, stronger local governments, mayors elected for the first time, has also produced lots of citywide upgrading schemes. I suppose the other thing that gives me hope is that in more and more cities, the slum dwellers are organizing themselves, forming their own federations. For instance, in India, the National Slum Dwellers Federation. In South Africa, the South African Federation of the Urban Poor. There's federations of slum dwellers now in 16 or 17 nations. These are taking the initiative, showing government that they can build houses, they can improve houses, they can install infrastructure as long as government support them. And I think this is a very hopeful sign in a field where there isn't much room for optimism elsewhere.
Well, all of this gives us clues of the ways aid for climate mitigation really could work. What do you suggest should happen?
Reward city governments that work with the inhabitants of informal settlements to put in place the infrastructure and services that build resilience to climate change.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. We're talking about climate and the developing world with urban expert David Satherwaite of the IIED in Britain. David, people like James Lovelock have predicted a wave of human migration brought about by climate change. Do you agree?
Migration is actually adaptation. People move for very sensible reasons. And most low-income households will try to get one family member in an urban area, some family members staying in rural areas, a cousin who gets abroad. And their survival strategy is a combination of all these. As economic opportunities change their location, so people's migration changes. So actually, migration is positive both for national economies and for the people who migrate. Now, only if there were catastrophes are people likely to try and migrate to Europe and North America. They don't want to move to Europe and North America in most instances. Their homes, their livelihoods, their family are in their own nation. Most migration is within that nation. Obviously, if we get catastrophes and millions and tens of millions dispossessed, lacking livelihoods, then maybe they'll look to migration to Europe or North America. But if the rich world commits itself to mitigation, to reducing greenhouse gas emissions, this shouldn't arise.
I do wonder, though, about the example of Port-au-Prince after the recent earthquake. Long lines of people left the city by any means available, as the media showed us, but the core population seems still stuck in the rubble. Why would people stay put after such disasters?
Well, poor Haiti. It's a very extreme example. I don't think it's typical of most of the cities and nations I've worked at. Look at the history of Haiti. Once the jewel in the French Empire, extremely wealthy, successful nation that has been bled dry by banks and reparations to the French government. It's awfully difficult to make judgments. I've never been to Haiti. I've never been to Port-au-Prince. But the rebuilding has to be around supporting the survivors and their social groups and their grassroots organizations and building from the bottom up. In a big disaster, once the foreign aid has come in and quite correctly come in to actually solve the emergency, then it's time to make way for low-income groups and their own community organizations to begin to take charge, to state their priorities, to help them build, to help them reconstruct their homes, their lives, their livelihoods. We've seen this having far better effects than a foreign organization-dominated reconstruction. That's my hope for Haiti now.
Yes, I agree with you. Now, look, I'd like to take just a second here to make a difficult case. Perhaps a billion people live in cities where their government does not or cannot care for them, and countless millions more will be exposed to new diseases or heat and pollution or droughts and floods with climate change. Yet so far, millions of people here in the West refuse to make even simple changes in their lifestyles that could maybe prevent millions of deaths in the future. So my conclusion is, doing nothing about greenhouse gases is a kind of population control. Am I going too far when I say things like that?
It's a death sentence to millions of people. If we refuse to commit to the 60 to 80% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions that all rich nations have to achieve in the next 30 to 40 years, yes, we're condemning millions to death.
And then we may become overwhelmed with the human tragedy and simply turn away from it.
That's the case, but also, I mean, the world economy is so interconnected. If a lot of these cities disappear, it's going to so disrupt the world economy. You know, you can't kind of create little citadels of self-sufficiency in the rich world. So it's in our interests to mitigate, to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And the costs to us are really quite small in relation to the costs avoided in all the cities and rural areas I work in, which aren't going to be able to adapt to the climate change induced if we don't do this.
Yes, we forget how interlinked we are. I mean, if Mumbai has a real serious situation, it will affect our economies here, don't you think?
Oh, certainly, yes.
Yeah. Well, you've also done calculations that conclude population growth is not the driving force behind climate change. Can you tell us about that?
Well, what drives climate change is consumption. And this means that a nation with very low average consumption contributes very little to greenhouse gas emissions. Typically, many sub-Saharan African nations have 1/200th of the emissions per person of the United States. You can also look at this in terms of people. A lot of my work is with slum dwellers, shack dwellers, and you look at their consumption levels. And they generate almost no greenhouse gas emissions in their homes and in their livelihoods. Many of them actually make a living from collecting waste. And if you credit them with the greenhouse gas emissions avoided by doing that, they've probably got negative emissions. Compare that with the high consumption lifestyle of the very rich. And one very rich high consumption family may be generating a million times more greenhouse gas emissions than, say, the pavement dwellers in Mumbai. What's driven the growth in greenhouse gas emissions is the growth in consumption, not the growth in population. For instance, London. London has a smaller population now than it had in 1941, but the greenhouse gas emissions caused by its population's consumption have multiplied many, many times.
Well, it seems the rich are always going on, or at least some of them, about population control, but we don't hear about reducing super consumption. I mean, there's some sort of limit on the number of houses you have, or how big they are, or what kind of yacht you buy. Those sorts of things aren't in the media.
No, I'd agree. The other issue about population is, of course, that if low-income groups have access to education, have access to security, have an adequate income, have a reasonable quality home, have access to health care, they have less kids. So the most dramatic way, if we think that population is an issue, is actually to have incredibly pro-poor supportive policies, improving housing, living livelihoods. And that has the double benefit of addressing poverty and, if you think it's important, reducing population growth. It won't reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
Returning to your own work with the IIED, my brain falters a bit when I consider your situation. You are actively engaged, I gather, in advising large funders on how to help people in cities, and yet we both acknowledge that chaos in urban life could be rising as governments and mega corporations seem to fumble or abdicate or just plain steal the money. So how do you reconcile the seemingly insoluble civil problems with your efforts to do something about it?
The founder of my institute, Barbara Ward, made this lovely comment. It's our duty to hope. Even if your rational analyses suggest that we're not going to succeed, in a sense, we're obliged to continue trying. And then where do I get the biggest buzz of optimism? when I spend time with the federations of slum dwellers and shack dwellers who achieve so much with very little, and if only we can reorient some of the development assistance, some of the aid, actually to support these grassroots organizations direct, most of them formed around women's savings groups, you can multiply 20-fold, 30-fold, 50-fold what each dollar of external support actually achieves. And it's when I spend time with them that I actually can see the potential for constructing cities that are just and fair and that have low greenhouse gas emissions.
In a way, you're talking about bypassing governments and working with NGOs and local populations.
No, because these federations are much too smart for that. They know that they've got to engage government. They don't have the luxury of trying to do anything autonomously. So, you know, they can put in neighborhood sewers and pipe water, but you need a water mains and you need a sewer mains to connect to. You can develop your own schools and your healthcare systems, but you want that integrated into a bigger picture. All the federations are actually offering local governments partnerships for building homes, improving water and sanitation. And it's around those local government, some federation partnerships that you really get the success. That was very much the point for the example from Thailand I mentioned earlier, where it's a government agency working with savings groups and networks of savings groups that has really delivered slum upgrading on a scale.
When it comes to cities in a shifting climate, what are the known unknowns? What should we be digging into more or doing more of?
Every city needs a good risk map, and think about what it's got to do in the next 5 to 25 years to limit risk and to avoid extreme weather becoming disasters. To think about who's at risk, to think about who's particularly vulnerable, to think who can't move quickly when a storm warning is coming. To think about healthcare services that have resilience when a storm hits. To think about emergency services that can cope. Every city, in a sense, needs to be looking at this and thinking about who, within its boundaries, has particular needs.
Is there anything you would like to add for our listeners as we finish off?
No, it was just a very nice opportunity to contribute to your program.
I appreciate you very much. Well, our guest on Radio EcoShock has been David Satherwaite, Senior Fellow in the Human Settlements Group of the International Institute for Environment and Development. I'm Alex Smith, and thank you again, David, for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
To get a grip on the mania, let's look at the top 10 consuming countries as measured by their ecological footprint. We'll list out the number of hectares each citizen requires to support their lifestyle. For our American listeners, 1 hectare is about 2.5 acres. Americans are no longer number one. That dishonor belongs to the people of the United Arab Emirates, each of which sucks out the resources from about 16 hectares of the earth. Here are the next in line. Number 2, the United States, 12.2. That's over 30 acres of resources for every man, woman, and child in the country. Number 3, Kuwait, 10.3 hectares per person. Number 4, Denmark, 9.8. Number 5, New Zealand, 9.5. Number 6, Ireland, 9.3 hectares each. Number 7, Australia, 8.4. Number 8, Finland, 8.4 hectares. Number 9, Canada, 7.6 hectares per person. And number 10, Sweden, 7.5 hectares per person. The United Kingdom comes in at number 16, using 6.29 hectares per capita. Let's take the example of the United States. It takes over 30 acres of resources per person for every American. The population was around 308 million in 2009. Multiply 30 times 308 million, you get about 9,240 million acres. But the U.S. is only 2.3 billion acres big. That means American consumers need to import materials more than 3 times the total size of the country from the land and the seas belonging to the rest of the world. If everybody else lives the American lifestyle, we need 5 or 6 planet Earths to supply all that stuff. Maybe this isn't going to work.
But there's a bigger issue at stake than just rubbish. And it has to do with turning back the tide of consumerism, something still so central to the American way of life. There's still a lot of work to be done.
there are lots of new programs out there, and we are reaching new diversion goals, and there is gained awareness in the society at large. At the same time, we see new, totally ridiculous disposable products coming online that are just obscene. You know, what do you need a disposable toilet brush head that you can, you know, clean your toilet and then flush it down the toilet, and it's got one use? It's an obscenity.
The amount of consumption that we have in the United States is absolutely off the scale of sustainability, and I think that we could definitely learn from other countries about how to meet our basic needs in a more sustainable manner.
That was a brief clip from the BBC program One Planet back in 2005. In the past 20 years, we worked hard on recycling. Now it's time for the next step. Stop buying new things. The planet is awash in cars, clothes, and gadgets. Buy used, or better yet, buy nothing.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
We're going to close out this show with the song Garbage from the American group Chairlift. You might remember their song Bruises from the launch of the fourth generation iPod Nano. They do a few good green tunes as well. Find them at chairliftmusic.com. Our song comes from their 2008 album, Does You Inspire You?